This week on A to Z Running, effort is finite. What does this mean for distance runners and what we call here at A to Z Running the first key to thriving? We also answer a listener question about flat legs during pre-race tapering. And in the world of running, the 10 featured 8 men under 27 minutes in the same 10,000 meter race. Has that ever happened before? Fast times weren't just limited to the track or the 10,000. Or the adults will share weekend rundown of the need to knows. And in other news, run talk is a thing. And we take a look at a recent article about it and share some thoughts. All this and more on A to Z Running. Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we're helping runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching services, which you can learn all about anything else that we do at atozrunning.com. Or if you like the social side of things in terms of media, then go to Instagram or YouTube or Spotify. Look for A to Z Running. We're there as well. So I have a thought. And I've been thinking it for some time and just kind of wondering about where the reality of this thought manifests. And I wanted to share it briefly before we get into things today. So we find that when weather gets colder, running wise, we start layering up, you know, bust out the cold weather running gear, all the stuff that comes with that. And in general, that's not a terrible transition, partly because it's an inevitable thing, partly because anecdotally, it seems like there's a little bit of, for runners at least, we have a little bit of excitement around like, oh, I can get out the gear that I haven't worn in a while, some of the kind of the cool stuff that I've got for cold weather things, or just, you know, something that's when it's a little bit cooler versus, you know, the hot if you're coming off of like summer, that's kind of a nice thing. And then it's just, it, you know, it gets cold gradually, usually. It depends on where you live, but it's not usually all at once suddenly. And so, it kind of like happens slowly. Now, contrast that with the end of the cold weather and the beginning of the warmer weather. And I have discovered, now you may disagree with me, and I'm grateful to hear your thoughts, whatever they may be, especially if they disagree, because I'm always interested in what you have to say. But my thought is, once we start wearing the warmer weather gear again, like start shedding the layers and running in shorts and all that kind of stuff, it is very hard for us to be willing to put back on the cold weather running gear, as far as I have observed and certainly felt personally. So what we tend to notice is when it gets warmer for a spell and then gets colder again, or something like that starts to happen, which tends to be the case in most places in the end of winter, early spring months. If that's the case, we are loath to run in the colder weather. It's like, oh, it's cold again, I can't do it. And so that becomes like treadmills used more readily than they might normally be used, or just this general sense of like, oh, this is terrible weather, when, you know, 3 months before it would be like, oh, that's so nice, it's balmy. I can run in thinner layers. I don't have to put on the, you know, the Eskimo gear or whatever the, you know, the thinking is. We still have this sense of like something about when it goes back and forth is very unpleasant. So my theory then in that sense is that when you taste of the good thing, it is so much harder to go back to the less good thing. Whereas when it's more of a kind of a natural transition, especially a gradual one, it tends to just be easier to, more palatable, let us say. Well, okay, so that's Zach ruminating on random things, which is what you get when Andy's not around. So deal with it. Or we can all say we are excited to have Andy back next week, where she'll be back on air with Zach. But for now, it's going to be a little bit of Zach today, and maybe I'll try to break it up with some interesting thoughts that you all are sharing, like this next one. And let's get right on to your questions. Thank you. Just a reminder, which we like to remind you of every opportunity we get. We love to hear your questions, and you can ask them very easily because all you have to do is send an email to the address questions@A2ZRunning.com. That's it. Questions@A2ZRunning.com. A-T-O-Z-Running.com. Send your emails with all your questions and your thoughts there. And then what we do is respond with some thoughts and answer them on air, depending on whether they, you know, they fit. If we have too many questions, we might not always get to all of them. We answer one or two each week. And depending on what else we have going on in the show, sometimes we can do two. Most of the time it's one. But if we can't answer your question on air, we will answer it in the email either way. So you'll still get some thoughts. But we usually find a way to make sure it's on air. So ask your questions. Send them to questions@A2ZRunning.com. That's an email. That'll work well. Now, this one is a question from Justin. Justin's running, actually just ran a half marathon, in fact. And leading up to this question was asking about how he was feeling in the final days. And so here's the question. My legs felt a little slow and heavy this morning with about a week to go, just under a week to go before the race. Despite running less during the past week, with easier efforts overall. And this is a familiar experience, a kind of tapering in the last couple of weeks. He went on to say, this happens most weeks before a race. Do you ever get that feeling and any idea what's going on? So thank you for asking, Justin. This is a very common feeling. Probably those of you listening are saying, yeah, I do get that feeling. Now, that is to say, most of us do experience that much of the time when we're tapering, or at least a lot of the time. And then some don't. And there's a number of potential reasons why those few don't, but they're less common. Now, that said, I am in the camp of those who don't actually experience much of that heaviness or flatness during a taper. And I don't know that I recall ever experiencing that except for in some few rare instances of like illness or something. But I can't tell you that there's certain something that I do that prevents that because I don't have anything to contrast it with. But I have worked with many other runners and helped through that. And so we have some thoughts to share, certainly. So, Justin, thank you for asking. Now, in your particular situation, the common taper for most people is 2 to 4 weeks of lessening volume and doing something different with intensity. Justin's taper here appears to be pretty typical in the sense of about 2 weeks of the volume lessening and intensity increasing. And the increase in intensity is getting shorter in quantity, but higher in overall effort. Not necessarily overall effort, but higher in specific intensity. So if that's the case, part of the rationale there is that should help sharpen your legs, make you feel more ready for a race during that period of time, both because you're fresher with a little bit less overall load, but also because the shorter, higher intensity things create a higher level of neuromuscular stimulus, which then is where that sense of sharpness comes from. That feeling of like quickness in my legs and poppiness and all of that, that comes from moving my legs quickly and having a poppiness in it. Now, that's question number one here, which is if I'm not feeling the sharpness and the freshness, it's possible that I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing in the training stuff that I'm doing. More on that. So that's consideration number one. Consideration number two is that it's also kind of inevitable that things like this are going to happen because you go from a period of time, and usually for most of us as runners, it's fairly long, 3 or 4 months maybe, of somewhat consistent overall loading of our system, somewhat consistent routines. And then we get into this taper period and we tend to change a lot of that. The overall loading changes substantially, as we noted, in many instances too much, by the way. We could talk about that a lot. But then also the routines change. And this is another consideration for you, Justin, that look at your general day-to-day routines in these situations. You always want to try to keep things as consistent as possible. So even if you're not running as much or you're running different kinds of efforts, you still want to try to follow that rhythm that you had before. Similar times of day that you're running, similar kinds of, like, if I'm going to run after work, here's the kind of the dynamic and what that looks like. Because if you throw off the routine too much, you're already changing some other things. And as we discuss frequently, we seem to find as runners that, and in general, that changing too many things at once is generally not preferable. So, all right, now back to the point then. So if you are then doing some things that could potentially not be helping you or even harming you in the training, what would that potentially look like? And so that's things like overdoing the intensity too much, too hard. What that's going to do is you're just producing, your body's not used to the kinds of intensity you're doing. For some people, they're not necessarily changing up the types of intensity much. And so it's not likely this source specifically, but if you're doing something that's unfamiliar, you have to be careful about it. And so if I'm increasing my intensity, shortening my durations of intensity, and then raising the overall height of intensity, if that's the kind of dynamic, which is common in a taper, then you may need to be cautious about how you're going about it. Because remembering that the point of these intense workouts is not to, like, hammer my body as hard as I can, because there's not enough time to achieve much, if anything, by that. In reality, the, like, hitting it hard and really digging deep, I need 6 weeks to achieve full benefit from those types of dynamics. And if I only have a couple of weeks, that's not enough time to really see adaptations. And instead, it's going to create a little bit of prolonged soreness, or not always soreness, but the central nervous fatigue, central nervous system fatigue manifests as that kind of flatness. And what I mean by that is the high neuromuscular demand of increased intensity, especially aggressive intensity, is fatiguing, but it's not fatiguing in the same way as muscular fatigue, like soreness. And so the fatigue there is a nervous system fatigue. And that's the firing mechanisms, that's the signaling mechanisms. And so if I fatigue that, I don't feel sore. I don't feel like anything's hurt. I just feel flat. Hence you can see the connection here. And so there, if you could be fatiguing that by the nature of what you're doing in this intensity. But on the other side of the coin, you can also be fatiguing that by not stimulating it enough. Well, I said that wrong. You're not fatiguing it. You're not stimulating it enough. And so your body, familiar with a certain routine and level of stimulus, is now not receiving much of that at all. And you're not making up for it with the right combination of intensities. And then you run into that same situation. So those are the kinds of sources. Now, I also noted when I shared a quick response to Justin, I noted here that there is a level of possible psychosomatic consideration. And I don't mean to say that the flatness you're feeling is just all in your head and it's not actually real in your physiology, because it most definitely is, even if it's also in your head. But the point is, I expect to feel a certain way, right, during this time. And if I'm not feeling that way, like I expect to feel good, fresh and sharp and all of that. And if I'm not, now we've created an expectation gap, which we talk all the time about. That's now mismatch theory rearing its ugly head again. And what that means then is, in most instances where there's mismatch in expectation versus what's actually happening, then I tend to feel an exaggerated sense of the negative there. And so that's likely also contributing to this, where what may just be kind of a little bit of flatness is now suddenly feeling like maybe my legs are in a worse state than they are. Okay, so what can we do about this? That's the extension of the question. Justin, in your situation, it's a little too late because you already ran that race. That's why I said I did share some thoughts with Justin right away, because the question was after last week's episode, so we wouldn't have been able to answer it on air, but his race occurred before this week's episode. So here's what the kind of the proactive side of things looks like. Keep the routine consistent as possible. Even though I'm running less, do other things that address that time potentially, like some extra mobility stuff, extra drills, like neuromuscular activation drills also, but strength and coordination sense of things, like precision movements. I wouldn't be trying to like lift weights at this point in time, but coordination drills, precision movements, and things of that nature. That's one great way to offset the gap in like physical loading. So I'm not doing as much volume, which means I'm not running for as much amount of time, but I'm still doing something in an active state, which helps with the central nervous system side of it. So that's one consideration. Also, keep a regular stimulus as well. And so this is not a point in time to take extra days off. Still do the same training cadence of running that you've been doing, but you're going to do it in lower volume, certainly. But if I before was running, you know, 90 minutes on a certain day, this time I'm running 45 or 60 minutes, but I'm still running. And don't take extra days off unless they're needed for some, you know, like recovery or injury or illness reasons. And then the last note here is, as mentioned, just be really careful to make sure that you're not overexerting in the hard efforts. And what I mean then, what that should look like is you are focused on the achievable goal by those efforts, which is the stimulus, neuromuscular activity. And so if you go out and you do intervals, for instance, stop doing intervals as soon as you start tiring, because at that point you're done achieving anything by that workout. And so do as many intervals as hard as you want, so long as they feel crisp and good. And as soon as they don't, stop the workout. That's long enough. How about other types of workouts though that are more sustained efforts and such? Well, you just have to always finish feeling like I could keep doing that. I've got plenty more to give if I needed to give plenty more. Keep them short, keep them brief. Even if you're doing like sustained harder efforts, they shouldn't be more than a couple miles. Even if you're training for a marathon at this point, that's not going to help you much anymore. So 2 or 3 or 4 miles or something of some quality running that's at a higher effort, but still careful to make sure that whatever the distance, whatever the effort, you finish feeling like I've got plenty more to give here if I had to, and you will have to when it comes to race day soon. And then just my final note, we get close to the race and we start to feel like we have this like urge to prove something to ourselves or to others because of Strava. You know how I feel about Strava. But so we have this urge to prove ourselves even only in my own eyes. And if that's the case, it tends to be that, oh, we're getting close to race day, which means now it's time to see the results, right? So then I start driving after things in workouts in a little bit different way than I would before. And what we do in that moment is we risk jeopardizing the entire season's preparation for this big race. It's the workouts are not time to prove anything to anyone. I would rather that everyone throw away their watches forever, I guess. But if you're not going to do it forever, at least in the last week or two, get rid of the watch. At that point, all that watch is doing is either disappointing you or creating an expectation. You don't want either of those at this point. You want to just do the thing your body needs to feel good for race day. And then you can get the watch back out and go crazy at the race and do it all. Okay, there you go, Justin. Thank you for asking. I much appreciate the question and nice work in the race. And we'll talk more about that here in a little bit. But if you have questions and you haven't answered or asked them yet, you should do so now by going to questions@A2ZRunning.com. And when I say going to, I mean sending an email to questions@A2ZRunning.com. All right, let's move on to something else helpful. As noted in the introduction, we here at A to Z Running have what we call our three keys to thriving. These are the principles that guide how we approach the stuff we do in supporting the athletes, but also more predominantly what we recommend is the kind of ordering of our efforts as runners and what that means then to be able to achieve the kind of experience that we want as a runner, and that is enjoyable, that is performance and achievement, accomplishment, and that is anything in between and everything in between. And so whatever the reason we're trying to do this thing, we think that these same principles apply to everyone. Now, one of them, I'm not trying to take this episode to talk about the principles, but one of them happens to connect to something that I've been encountering a fair bit lately in other contexts, and I wanted to share some thoughts, and then get into a quick preview, tease you a bit about what's coming that we're going to be sharing here soon in an upcoming series of episodes. So here's the idea. We are often talking about prioritizing how we direct our energy. That's one of those three keys to thriving. We call it channeling the energy. And so how we channel the energy is the essentially the key. And so what it amounts to here is, as I'm contemplating this, I'm encountering in reading and especially in a particular author, if I've mentioned him before, Dave Stewart is his name. He's a teacher. He's a high school teacher who writes about teaching. And yet his comments about teaching and learning tend to have a lot of like big life application. It's one of the things I love about Dave. Dave is one of those guys who has his finger on the concept of wisdom, not just like knowing information, but wisdom. And I can't say that I'm the one to judge that, except for that it's clear and abundantly clear in the nature of the things that he does and shares. So anyway, point is, Dave Stewart is talking about in some material lately about how effort is taxing and limited. Like my effort that I have to give to something, when I do so, taxes me, and as such, is not infinite. And I would add to that, Dave adds to that, and I would just include with it focus as well, because that's so where I direct my attention, not just what I do, but even what I'm attending to that I may or may not actually be doing actively. So both of those are finite, effort and focus. And among other things, certainly, but if in this context, the implications of that fact, that so that anything that takes effort on our part has a kind of draining effect on some arbitrary limit. Like there's a well of, or let's call it a supply of effort. And when we do something, we are withdrawing from that supply of effort. So when it's empty, when the supply is gone, our capacity and even willingness to give effort plummets, like our motivation to give effort plummets. And so this is obviously not a physiological thing per se. For instance, efforts that I'm describing here are not necessarily physically taxing. They might not require much exertion in our physiology, but can still be substantial efforts or a substantial drain on our supply of effort. So anything that requires us to direct effort, and that's why I'm attaching the concept of attention to this. Giving our attention to something takes effort. What's fascinating about that, which I will get into in a moment, is that not everything, we don't always give our attention deliberately to things. So like something's just taking my attention, if you will, and yet that is still consuming some of this supply of effort, attention, focus stuff. Okay, now this is really kind of idea level. We'll get more specific. But I did want to mention that I am grossly oversimplifying this in my current description, because you have to think about things like, okay, so if there's a supply of effort, we have to also account for the fact that some things fill that supply up. And it's not always just being drained. There are certain kinds of things we might do. There are certain kinds of activities we might do that actually restore our reserves. For instance, sleeping tends to be a thing, like rest tends to be a thing that restores our reserves. But there are many things, and they are very unique to us individually. And for instance, that's where the introvert-extrovert principle comes into something like this. For some people, alone time restores some of that supply. And for other people, alone time actually drains some of that supply. Like, I don't enjoy being alone, and so it requires some additional focus and attention, where if I can be in a group of people, with especially with my people and my kind of comfort zone, and when I'm in my comfort zone and I can feel like, you know, things are just really revitalizing me. People like me, an unrepentant introvert, such as I am, I do not enjoy. No, that's the wrong word. Enjoy is the wrong word here. It's not that I don't enjoy social settings. I actually do. I pretty much always enjoy a social setting, but it's draining. And so there's a limited supply of that before it just kind of feels like it's gone. But as I said, it's not just like draining all the time, because there are certain things, even in that moment for me, there's certain things that can also be filling it at the same time. So it's also not a one way, there's not like one nozzle in the supply that things are, this analogy is getting out of hand. But also, okay, so it's also not linear. And this is in principle, hinges upon so many different things. Remember Daniel Pink's work. He's the author of the book When, which is the science of perfect timing or something. And so in that book, he talks about how different times of day are our efforts or our energy supply is more and less just by the nature of times of day. So that's important. Like in the morning, if you're a morning person, it's a vast supply. If you are not a morning person, it actually starts close to empty and needs to slowly fill as you wake up and go about beginning your day. If you're a night person, it fills up in the nighttime. And so there's like more supply. But if you're not a night person, it's gone. No matter what you do, it's gone. And what do you do with that? And then there's other things like we find that for almost all people, the period of time immediately following midday, which is usually lunchtime for most of us, that's one of the most difficult times in terms of this effort supply. So, all right, you get the point. It's not linear. It goes up and down, but also it can be happening at the same time. And so that being the case, we have to make some assumptions here to have the conversation for the next few minutes. But in all of these potential caveats, we still understand the basic premise. Effort and focus are finite and as such can be exhausted and are being exhausted by various different things that we do. Now, I mentioned earlier, and this is when I wanted to get into it for a moment, it's not always deliberate. I'm not always intentionally directing my focus, but it can still be draining me. For instance, lots of studies around sustained idle screen time. So we're not talking about like interactive screen time, but idle screen time creates or helps or generates further difficulty focusing on mundane tasks, like uninteresting things, things that aren't sensational to me in some sense. So idle screen time, no matter what that screen time is in fact doing, insofar as it is idle, not active, not interactive, not stimulating in a multi-dimensional sense, then it tends to drain me even though I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting looking at a screen, right? And so this brings up questions around things like, you know, if I'm just perusing media of any kind on my phone, I'm not trying to dogpile on social media right now. I may do that again, but I'm not trying to do that at the moment, but instead just simply saying that whatever the thing is I'm doing. So in another sense, another passive drain of our focus and attention is chaotic environments or busy environments. So it might not be something that I'm actively involved in, but being in a chaotic environment. And I'm not talking about just like active social environments, because for many, as I mentioned earlier, for many, that's like a really rejuvenating thing. But chaotic environments cause a kind of sensory overload for many people, if not most people, and it creates a focus or attention issue. It's draining our focus because it's going in so many directions at once. It's draining very quickly, especially if we feel like there's a need to engage with that chaotic environment, but we don't have a clear path to productive engagement with it. So in that instance, and this is a kind of an important example, but not one that's directly relevant to runners, but in a classroom, for instance, a chaotic classroom environment is almost always bad for students. But what's interesting is it's almost never bad for the teacher, because the teacher is the one who's engaging with it in a productive sense. Like, it's whether it's deliberate or whether it's, in my mind, has some clarity. But the students tend to suffer from that, and it's usually because of a focus attention dynamic. But anyway, so that aside, we've got a clear sense here that there are a lot of different ways that this supply can be drained. And so, what do we do with this? And this is where I wanted to spend just another couple minutes. This creates the need for, this is making the case for my comment earlier, that we need to channel our energy deliberately. We need to prioritize how we channel our energy. It's not a luxury, not something like, oh, that would be nice, but if in fact we must do this, or we're really likely to suffer in quality of life sense. So first in the three keys to thriving, channel the energy. The reason it's first is because we feel very strongly that if we don't get this thing right, that the rest of what we try to do as runners is like training and stuff, it's rarely productive, consistent, or sustainable if we can't get the balancing the energy right. If we do get it right, then it is so much easier to be successful with the other stuff. And what I mean by get it right is achieve the balance of deliberately directing my effort and energy into things productively, into things that align with my goals, align with my values, those types of things. So what does it look like then in terms of the choices that we're making? I'm going to run down a few here, just some of the common ones, and just kind of give a quick few examples and end with my top two recommendations. Here you go. So here's a good scenario that comes up a lot. Do I run more, do strength stuff more, or stretch more? Because we only have so much time, but even more so, we only have so much effort and energy to give. Even if I had extra time, still limited there. So here's the thing. I mean, we got to, if we're trying to decide that in the moment, that's a rough decision to make, because it all already the decision itself is additional effort. So we got to be strategic there. I mean, it'd be good to. So we just establish a set of clear, like, here's what I need to do in a given week. This is my plan overall. I need to get in two, well, our recommendation is 2 days that include some additional strength and stability types of work. And then, mobility stuff as often as we are able to do it for at least a few minutes after running, especially. So that kind of shifts around depending on what exactly we're doing in training and where we are in a build up toward a primary goal or something. Early days, more strength focus makes sense. Middle days, we don't want to sacrifice the key runs for the sake of extra strength work, but we try to maintain some kind of base consistency. And then the later days, we tend to set aside some of the extra strength work, and that's kind of like in the final race stage prep. So that's one example. Now, how about should I get more sleep or run longer in the morning? Should I wake up earlier to run longer or get that sleep? As we mentioned, sleep is a rejuvenating factor in most senses for effort and focus types of supply. And so when we lose sleep in exchange for more running, it's actually a double negative. Which it doesn't, that's not exactly the right way to say that. But as the sleep is going down and the run time is going up, we are increasing the amount of effort and decreasing the amount of rejuvenation. So that's why I say it's doubly negative. That's a dangerous thing to play with. So we have to exercise caution. That doesn't mean we never do that, but it means that if we're doing that, we need to be aware of the potential greater effects than just, I'm a little bit sleepier today than normal. Which, by the way, increases the effort toll on other mundane things through the day. So you see my point. If I lose sleep and it has an effect, now, one day cutting my sleep a little bit short probably isn't going to have any effect at all. But if I need that sleep during that time, it's going to have probably not even just linear curve effects, but exponential curve effects, because it is increasingly causing additional problems. Now, that's why we have to be deliberate and strategic about that. Okay, so keep that in mind. And it's not just, the time and do I take the run and lose the sleep this time, or do I not this time? Because it's also like, what else is going on in life? Because those things are not happening in isolation. Is it a very busy day? Do I have a lot of other things that are important to me that day that I'm going to be attending to? If so, that's probably not the best day to lose sleep for the run. But you got to weigh that depending on your situation. Here's another one. Why is running after work harder than before work for nearly every human being? Well, in this case, because my effort supply is lower after a long day of work. And sometimes it needs a little bit of rejuvenating before I can muster enough to go do the run. So that those are negative signs. If that's the case, it tells me that I am doing enough of draining that supply that it may not be effective to run at that state when I'm in that state. And so some days it might be better than other days, and try to clue into that and why that is, and make it as predictable as possible. This is, by the way, worsened even more so by things like bad weather or undesirable workouts. Like here's the run that I should be doing today is one that I really don't like as much. Remember that eat the frog thing we talked about a while back on the podcast? Eating the frog is like the idea of do the thing that is least desirable as soon as possible, so that it's out of the way. And if you have to eat a frog, eat it in the morning. Don't wait until the evening because you're thinking about it all day. So if you've got an undesirable workout, do it in the morning. And that might be a day to lose a tiny bit of sleep. Well, it depends on everything else. But bad weather example, if I'm going to run after work and then it's also like cold rain or something, it takes greater effort supply to go run when I'm less interested in going running. Okay, last one here. Second to last one. Why is it easier to run when something else I enjoy is involved? So this is a positive question. So like a running buddy, why is it easier for me to run when my running buddy's running with me? Or why is it easier to run when I'm at a location that I really like and it's just a really fun place for me to run? Well, the answer is because those things are rejuvenating things. And so there's greater amounts of rejuvenation happening than normal. And the drain might be the same in a fundamental sense, but it's ultimately less because, the net sum of the rejuvenation and the drain is more positive than it would have been. So yes, it makes perfect sense that if it takes effort for me to do this thing, but then that other aspect is something that kind of rejuvenates me in some sense, that it's actually going to feel like it's easier to do it. Just point blank is easier, because it is easier to do it, less taxing. Okay, so I like that. Now how about the last one here? I like to pull out my phone and scroll around a bit when I'm getting ready to run. You knew I was going to say this eventually. You knew it because you have been listening for at least 10 minutes to what I've been talking about. My apologies if sometimes it sounds old hat when Zach is curmudgeon-y about things like this, but it really does need to be addressed frequently, and I think that's worthwhile. But in this context, let me put it in a different context and be not just be belligerent here, but I want to do that. I finished that long day of work and I finally have a chance to just kind of chill for a few minutes. I want to get on my phone. I want to scroll around and stuff. And I'll be going for a run here in just a little bit. Stop. Don't do it in that moment. Simple reason. That phone time is not rejuvenating you in almost every sense. It is definitely not rejuvenating you. It is possible. I don't know exactly what you're doing with the doom scroll, but it's possible that there are some things that could rejuvenate, but it's not. Don't tell yourself that, because it's not. That is a mismanagement of your focus. You are draining more of your supply but it feels like it's not, because you're getting a dopamine release from the stinking device or whatever you're doing on the device. And so it's deceiving you. It's like drinking caffeine. It makes you feel like you have energy, but you actually don't. Well, technically you kind of do with the caffeine scenario. But anyway, maybe that's a bad example. Point is, you don't actually get more energy. You don't get energized by that in the sense of like your effort supply. You get a false sense of energizing most of the time. I will acknowledge that there are instances that defy the thing I'm stating here. There's always going to be an exception. But here's my thought, though. What am I actually trying to do right now? Where am I trying to direct my attention? You know, I'm trying to get ready for a run. Focus on that without additional distraction, and it will be easier to do the run. But it also I'll feel better about the run, because as soon as you have the phone out, to put the phone away and go for a run creates a sense of loss. It's a huge effort drain to set the thing down. Remember the dopamine release. We are addicted to it. Whether or not we do that a lot, we have some sense of addiction to that. Well, maybe that's too strong a word. But anyway, the point is we have some sense of, like, I feel a loss when I have to stop. And if that's the case, which it is, then don't put yourself in that situation, because it's making it harder and a greater drain on your effort to do that run. So, all right, there we go. That, you've heard me say it. Now I've said it. Final two recommendations here based on all of these thoughts. Number one, structure and strategize the week or the day, but I would do it a week at a time, because it tends to be easier, like on a certain weekend day where you don't have as much pressing in terms of general attention. That's a great time to just take a look at the week. This doesn't have to take more than like 2 minutes. Take a look at the week, account for the things that you know are coming, and the where the heavier weight is in different days, different times and such, and then plan what you're going to do. When are you going to get more sleep? When are you going to get a little less sleep? I would encourage you to try to keep sleep as consistent as possible, but there's always going to be some ebb and flow with that. And plan accordingly all the things that you need to make sure, you know, the important stuff you need to make sure happen. Number two, assign time and space for all the things, and then stick to it. I am not telling you to never get out your phone and dink around in the places with the stuff. And I say this, so it might sound condescending when I say that, but I do it as well. And I'm not condemning the act of interacting with content on your phone. there are some of those, some content on your phone that you might interact with that I may condemn, but from the perspective of, I don't think it's actually doing us any good. But whatever the case may be, we can do that if we must, but we should be deliberate about when we do it. Do not let the doom scrolling control you. Take charge. Okay, that's it. Now, all of that to be said, this was really just kind of a preface of some of the important considerations where we did not address the elephant in the room here, which is making these kinds of decisions is actually itself very difficult, or so they tell us. And I think anecdotally, we would all agree. So what I'm going to do is, once Andy's back with us, we're looking at a book by Jim Lohr called Wise Decisions, a science-based approach to making better decisions. It's not specific to runners, although he has a lot to say about athletics and athletes specifically. But we're going to dive into some of the key suggestions in that work and bring to our table here what we can do to be better at making the good decisions we want to be making as runners. And certainly the general life implications are going to be present as well. So there you go. That's where we're headed with this. If you were wondering, why are you doing this right now, Zach? Why are you talking about this? That's the stuff. And I look forward to digging into that more with you. I also always enjoy your comments and your thoughts and reaction too. Many of you, as we've shared, especially as we share like a reaction to a work like in this instance, many of you have sent us notes and comments on the social medias and emails saying, hey, here's what I read the book also, and here's what I thought, or I took a look at the thing that you were talking about, and here's my thought about it too. And those insights and reactions and ideas, I love it. Share away. With that, let's set it aside for now and get on to the world of running. A lot of exciting things to talk about, starting with some A to Z running people, some A to Z runners of ours who were racing over the weekend and out there doing the good stuff. So a shout out, by the way, to Robert. And we'll be talking about this here soon, but Robert is running a marathon in Antarctica in the very near future. if all goes well. He's scheduled to do so. So that's exciting. We'll let you know once we know more information. Yeah, as you might guess, it's not the kind of thing that you get information quite as quickly and as readily as, you know, the Chicago Marathon in your backyard or something. But anyway, that's cool. So Spencer ran the Bay City St. Paddy's Day 5K. Congrats, Spencer, on getting out there, putting in some time. Andrew and Kyle ran the Leprechaun Chase 5K, and Andrew was first in his age group. Kyle was second in his age group, and they're in two different age groups, which is fun. So they didn't have to try to kick each other off those spots. But both getting in and competing, and that was exciting as well. Well done. And Justin ran the Rock CF Half Marathon also, and a very strong effort at that. Great work, all. Speaking of great work, the 10, which many have expressed is the silliest name for a track meet. as these things go, I don't know what the issue is right now with the track world in the United States, but we're not taking it seriously, and it's poor reflection on the sport. So they named New Balance's massive new indoor track and field facility, you know, the one that they've been like using for all the big events this year. I mentioned New Balance Indoor Nationals, that was there. Then NCAA Championships was there, other races. They named it The Track. And I have to say, to people who aren't like track fans, that just looks a little silly. And they named one of the meets that, I think it's Sound Running actually, which is the same one that does the 10. They named it The Track Meet. And I don't have much else to say except I think maybe that's not helping our cause. But this one's called The 10 because it was, once upon a time, a 10,000 meter race. And so they called it The 10. And now there's actually more than just the 10,000 meter race. So it doesn't even make sense to have that name anymore. I will not say any more on that. All right. This race was crazy. It was amazing. Crazy. And it started with, I don't know the order, but the first one I have here was on the men's race. Just mass insanity. It was so fast. So, but not like just fast up front. It was fast up front, although not as fast as it was last year up front, but it was so deep. And so here's what happened. Last year, Grant Fisher set the American record at this event. If you recall, he ran 26:33. Was that last year or 2 years ago? Anyway, Grant Fisher ran 26:33 at this event once, and that was a massive national record. And this time around, he took a very different approach. So Grant Fisher's in the race. Actually, what it amounts to is like all of the United States' best top 10,000 meter runners were in this race. Not every single one of them, but, you know, most of them, and Grant Fisher included. And he ran a very different race than he usually does for these kinds of things. He just sat back and did nothing until the last 100 meters, and then he unleashed a massive kick and he beat them all. That's kind of a bold move, Grant Fisher, but you know what? He said, I was here just to try to get the time and you know, compete well, and wasn't really going to try to, you know, do anything more than that. And so that, you know, how fast the race was meant how fast he was going to run, and he won. And he, you know, great work. And he ran 26:52, which is the Olympic standard. The Olympic standard is 27 minutes flat for the men, by the way. And so anyone under 27 minutes gets the standard. Well, Grant Fisher won the race in 26:52, but this is the crazy part. Seven more men behind Fisher, also ran under 27 minutes and all achieved the Olympic standard. So now we're talking about 8 men within an 8-second window ran across the finish line. And how crazy is that, right? So it was just a mad dash to the finish and all things unleashed. And here's where it just gets amazing. So first of all, that's only ever happened once before in the history of time. Has there been more than, and it was 9. And so one more person. And that was back in 2011, by the way, 13 years ago, 9 men ran under 27 in the same race. But in this particular instance, 8 did it. And that's amazing. But we got to talk about who these people are. In second place, yes, second place was Northern Arizona University's own Nico Young. We've been talking about him so much this winter time because he's just been unleashed. Nico Young is something new now this year, finally. And you recall last weekend he won the double at the NCAA Championships, his first and second title in one weekend. And then he comes back this weekend and he smashes the NCAA record in the 10,000 meters. Like, we're talking 16 seconds or so. And he runs second place against a stacked professional field, international stacked professional field, runs 26.52. Just an incredible performance. You recall Nico Young also smashed the NCAA 5K, 5,000 meter record indoors as well. So now he's just notching his belt. Well, that, by the way, that record in the 10,000 was previously held by Sam Chalenga. Now, if not for Nico Young, University of New Mexico's Haptum Samuel also would have smashed the previous NCAA record because he finished in fifth place here in 26.53. So remember how I said it was just a mad dash. They're all super close together. 26.53 for the second fastest collegian ever in the same race as Nico Young. So that's crazy. Haptum Samuel, by the way, is Eritrean. And so not a national record, but not far off of the best times run by the best Eritreans in time. So the other guys were no less impressive. We got to talk about this. Andreas Almgren ran a new Swedish record when he finished in third place. He ran 26.52 and change, number three all time on the European list, and notably is the fastest European-born European time as well. Depending on how things stack up here, he certainly has a Swedish record, top three in Europe. This guy's looking like a top contender at the Olympics at this point. Adrian Wildschut of South Africa set a new record, national record, when he finished sixth in 26.55. Mo Ahmed from Canada, Woody Kincaid from U.S., and Edwin Kurgat of Kenya also all ran under 27 minutes for an Olympic standard, marking the eight men who finished. And it should be noted, there are 78 men total ever to have broken 27 minutes in the 10,000 meters. Five were born in North America, one in Europe, that's Andreas Almgren, and the other 72 in Africa. So you get a sense of, like, this is a major achievement for anybody. And 78 men ever. And so these guys, all eight of them, are eight of the best 78 10,000 meter runners in the history of time. That's crazy. In the same race. That's really something. By the way, some additional national records were happening further back in the race. So even though they didn't run the Olympic standard, they're still best in their country ever. Jack Rayner ran the new Australian record, 27.09. Luis Grijalva, Guatemalan record in 27.26. And Gulveer Singh, a new Indian record in 27.41. And I should mention, if you were paying attention earlier, three American men were in that list of eight, ran under 27. Three American men in the same race. Prior to this race, three American men had ever run under 27 minutes. And in this race, three did it at the same time. Now, granted, Grant Fisher had already run under 27 minutes. He's got the American record. But the other two were new to Nico Young, and Woody Kincaid. Both had never done so before. And so now you've got even like the list just vastly changed. So that's really incredible. Also, I wanted to note that this kind of gave us like a sense of the Olympic preview for the United States, because it was pretty much just about all the hopefuls who were looking for times. And we got three spots unlocked for the United States, guaranteed now in the 10,000 meters because they ran the three standards. And that matters. So now no one has to chase standards for the 10,000 because the U.S. has three spots available. So that's really cool. It kind of like takes off some pressure, which is definitely exciting. And as it stands, it's definitely the case that Fisher looks like kind of a shoe-in for the Olympic team. you know, last year proved that even though you can look good during the season, the championship still has to go well. But Woody Kincaid's also always hard to bet against, and he's just looking fly, running that fast. And Nico Young is like this quiet threat now that you just don't know exactly how he's going to handle the long season. The NCAA season is always very long. And coming off of that, then going straight to U.S. trials, we'll see. But it's exciting. And the women's race, no less exciting. It was certainly very different, though. So what ended up happening was the initial pacers for the women were sent out to run under 30-minute pace. But the women's Olympic standard is 30:40. So there was actually a second set of pacers running the Olympic standard pace. So only two women went out for that early pace. And it was Alicia Munson of the United States who wanted this because she's trying to break the American record. It's her own record, 30:03, but no Americans run under 30, and so she wants to try to be the first. But then also, world cross country medalist from Ethiopia, Sigai Gebrselassie, was driving this race. And so, as such, when Munson ended up struggling pretty heavily early on, it was Gebrselassie who then took over and, with no pacer, went on to run 29:48 for the fastest time ever run on U.S. soil. We call that an all-comers record in the United States, which I don't understand why people in the U.S. don't use that phrase, all-comers record. People in other athletics divisions across the world regularly talk about that in concept. So the all-comers record is the person who runs the fastest in that place, being usually a country. And so, like, there's European and then there's like British all-comers records, or European and France. So there's like two layers there. But as far as in the United States, we just don't ever talk about that. That phrase is rarely ever used. But this is an all-comers record for Gebrselassie in the 10,000 meters, running 29:48. Number 9 all time in the world, and a big personal best for her at that. So very impressive stuff. Well, Alicia Munson, I mentioned, she faded. She actually ended up dropping out. Turns out she has had a stomach bug and was not good. So that definitely makes things harder. But she's not terribly worried about it because she does already have the Olympic standard from last year. The 10,000 meters gets an extended qualifying window, and so she's got the standard, which means the spot for the United States was already unlocked. She can't unlock it again, and so that's not a major deal, except that it's just a bummer that she couldn't get out there and test herself. Behind those two, the rest of the field was doing some other stuff, and so their pacer unfortunately didn't last very long, just a mile and a quarter in, 5 out of 25 laps. It's not a lot of help, but they had the pace lights and they had a bigger pack of people to help out. But it was initially Carisha Schweitzer from the United States who wanted to try to move up toward the leaders. She ended up paying for that and faded back quite a bit. But Wayne Kaladi then of the United States did most of the late work to really drive the group after that Olympic standard time. Remember, that time was 30:40. Wayne Kaladi finished in second then after Munson dropped out, and she finished second in a time of 30:33, got the standard. Lauren Ryan from Australia set a new national record when she ran 30:35. Side note for Lauren Ryan, that was almost 90-second PR. If you do the math, Lauren Ryan went from running 32:09 to 30:35, so more than 90 seconds. She skipped running in the 31s altogether. That's crazy. Mind-boggling. Lauren Ryan, by the way, trains in the United States in the Baltimore Run Mission, UA Baltimore Run Club. That name is a really strange name, so I always have a hard time remembering it. But the Under Armour Run Mission Baltimore Club. All right. Megan Keith then also finished under the Olympic standard. She's British, from Scotland specifically, and ran in her debut 10,000 meters. She ran 30:36 at 21 years of age. That's amazing. That's very impressive. She was being likened to Parker Valby. She's the Scottish Parker Valby or something. But that's, you know, she's her own person, so she doesn't have to be compared to someone else. But it was just, if those who have been paying attention to Parker Valby's career noticed some similarities. Anyway, let's go further back still, though, because Florencia Borelli also set a new Argentinian record when she ran 31:33. So not an Olympic standard time, but a new Argentinian national record. I should note that on the women's race, there were a number of other standouts in the field, including Kira D'Amato and Sarah Hall. Both who were Olympic hopefuls in the marathon, but it didn't work out for them. So now they're looking at trying to see if they can nab something in the 10,000. Well, they weren't there this time around. About a minute off of what they would need to be. But we'll see. We'll see how things progress for them. So in general, at the 10, 7 national records, 12 Olympic qualifiers, and a very interesting reflection from Let's Run about how the top women are way faster than the next tier of women. And that's a little bit interesting. But the top men, it's a much closer gap. So for instance, the world record in the men's 10,000 was like 40 seconds faster than what the men ran in this particular race. The world record holder, if he was in that race, would have won the race by like 300 meters. But on the women's side, the world record's like, doing quick math in my head, like a minute and a half faster than the Olympic standard for the women. And so with the exception of Gebrselama, who won the race, the world record holder would have won by almost 600 meters in the women's race, so almost double the distance to the Olympic standard. So yes, that's a big discrepancy, and it just speaks to the side of the sport. They don't function exactly the same in between the history and what is going on currently and different people and their successes. So I don't know. I don't have anything else to say about it except that it was an interesting observation from Let's Run. Now, next on the list here, I just wanted to kind of do a quick rundown of the other things that have been happening, because at the 10, there was also a 1500 meter race. The only thing I want to mention about it was that Sadie Englehart, a junior in high school out of California, ran the number 5 fastest 1500 meters by a high school girl in the history of the United States. She beat the pro field. She won the race running 409.7. And oddly enough, of those top 5 girls in the history of high school 1500 meters, 4 ahead of her have to date never beaten their high school PRs. That's not great. That's not a good look. So Sadie Englehart hopes that she will continue to progress here. And yet it's not always the case. Now, the Laredo 10K, which was over in Spain, and you can qualify for the Olympic track events, some of them with road races, especially the 10,000. So in a 10K on the roads, if it's a certain level of World Athletic certification, then you may be able to qualify. And that's exactly what happened for Yamiv Kijelcha and Joshua Cheptegei running against each other in the Laredo race. Kijelcha from Ethiopia just mashed Cheptegei. And you find out after the fact, well, actually, I guess they were talking about it ahead of time too, but apparently Cheptegei never really was going to try to beat him, because Kijelcha wanted to run close to the world record road race time. Like, he wanted pacers to be set at that. And Cheptegei just wanted to qualify under 27 minutes. So very different. Kijelcha ended up winning with a 26:37, which is number 3 all time on the road. And as it were, 1 second better than Cheptegei's personal best on the road 10K. So that was kind of funny. Cheptegei being in the race, but Cheptegei did run the Olympic standard just a little bit further back. On the women's side, Constanze Klosterhoffen from Germany won the women's race, but did not run a qualifying time. She went out fast, but faded hard and struggled a bit, but still won the race. Elsewhere, Jimmy Gressier of France ran a new 10,000 meter European record. 10K, sorry, European record on the roads. And so He outkicked Kenya's Jacob Krop, who is a world 5,000-meter medalist. Very impressive feat. Gressier has been doing some crazy stuff on the roads. He's got the European 5K record now in 13:12. Add it to this one. Now he's got the European 10K record in 27:07 on the roads. By the way, as mentioned, you can qualify for the Olympics. He only narrowly missed the Olympic standard, but he's not concerned about it, meaning he's pretty confident he'll get that when he goes for it. And then one other one here. Apparently, there is a six-day ultramarathon record or world best. And we know that because Camille Herron just broke it. So not terribly surprising that she would. Lululemon's further race is a six-day stage race. And Camille Herron covered in the 6 days 560 miles and change. And en route to that, broke the 300-mile, 400K, 600K, and 400-mile world bests as well. So she racked up five new world bests in a single event. That's not a bad way to do it. Congrats to Camille Herron once again. In other news, and this may be something we try to do a little bit more regularly here, which is not just share running results with you in the world of running news, but also like what our publications writing about as they pertain to our sport. And this one came up as I was looking through some different publications, and I thought I'd share it with you because it relates to our main topic that we were discussing earlier, Run Talk. Have you heard of it? Have you heard of Run Talk? It's a thing. It is. I'm not making this up. The question is it a good thing? And so this is published by Outside Online's Run. And the publication was orienting around what is this Run Talk thing and what are the pros and cons. So if you're familiar with TikTok, I'm not. So you will know whether I'm even describing this accurately. And I won't. I won't have a clue. But Run Talk apparently is just like a hashtag that people use on TikTok. And so as best as I can understand it, I don't really know how these things work. But what that means then is that people are on TikTok sharing about running stuff, and this is kind of like an area where that happens. And you've got all these influencers, because that's a thing, and people are that. And so they were giving examples. You got the 100 miles guy, and he's a 100 miles guy because he's got apparently a 180-week streak of 100-plus miles a week for 180 weeks in a row. First thought, that's bad. Don't do that. Not that it's bad to run a lot, but it's bad to create a streak like that because you're creating a need that is entirely artificial and counter to your general well-being to have a need to do that thing simply to call it a streak. I hate streaks. They're terrible. All right. Strong language from Zach there, but it's true. There's also another guy they were talking about, and he's famous because he's got a daily run streak that's like years and years long. I don't know what his weekly mileage is like. Apparently, it's not 100 miles every week, or maybe he'd be the 100 guy too. But anyway, and his whole thing is this daily run streak. And once again, same response. That is not a healthy thing, ultimately, for people in general. I don't know the specifics of these individual people's situations. I'm not going to judge whether it's unhealthy for them, but I think it's bad influence all around. Now, let me get into the details here. So that was just a couple of examples. They shared a couple others, and they were for various other kinds of reasons, like you don't have to be like this one type of runner to be a runner. Like there's other people who run also. You don't have to run for certain reasons. You can have other reasons to run, like all that kind of stuff, right? So here's a couple things I wanted to draw out from the article. So in particular, a quote from one of these influencers, "Let me go do stuff so I have something to post," was the like sense that a person gets. And the comments went on to say, which can be dangerous. If it's not genuine and you're just doing it for the trend, it can only go so far. That's one of the influencers saying about this. "Let me go do stuff so I have something to post" is exactly what I'm talking about. That's bad. And this person obviously is recognizing that. I'm not saying that this person is a cause of the problem. But in the spirit of why did I do that thing? Well, I made sure to go at least for the walk because then I can put that on my Strava and I have to keep up my Strava, or in this case, run talk. But who cares? But that is that really truly a thing you should be doing? And if the answer is yes, great, do it, no problem. But if the answer is no, then it's a lot harder for you to arrive at that no when you have other things motivating you to do it that are not part of the core rationale. Is that a thing that I should be doing? Okay, next comment from the article. One of these other ones went on to say, it would be nice if the algorithm awarded positivity and the importance of exercise rather than dangerous challenges like streaks, by the way. Negativity, I guess I'm a little bit to blame for that right now. I will try to be less negative. And sexualization. And we all know that's true. And then he goes on to say, but those things seem to be what people want to see. So I don't know. I'll just keep making my content and hope it makes a difference. Wrong. Those things are not being shown by the algorithm because they're things people want to see. They're being shown by the algorithm because the algorithm is generating based on the sense that people take action when you do certain things to their minds, when you make them afraid, when you make them angry, when you induce certain sensations. That's what the algorithm is based on. Remember, the algorithm is not trying to show people. We know this because the people who make these things have talked about it. You're not trying to show people things because that's quantitatively what people are clicking on or scrolling slower past or something. It's because if you generate a certain behavioral response, and we would call it more an emotional response, you're not actually doing something behaviorally generally, but if you generate that emotional response, you're likely to captivate your audience longer. The algorithm is designed to do one thing: keep your attention. That's it. That's all it cares about, if an algorithm could be said to care. And so as such, the thing this guy's saying here, recognizing right away, well, yeah, the algorithm awards, rewards really unhealthy things a lot of unhealthy things. Yeah. Yep. And it always will. That won't stop. It's not a fluke. It's a design principle. It's the design principle. So let's pause on Zach's rant for a moment. And they went on to say, so there's some positives. And I agree. There are some positives. Community, sense of being a part of something, meeting real people, and could translate to interacting with real people in real places. We go to this event. We see each other. It's like, yeah, we're this thing. All of that can be great stuff. You can learn things. You can actually learn things. It's unlikely, but you can. And they brought in a sports psych. Jeff Ruzer is his name, associated with the NCAA. And he was writing a little bit about this and some of the concerns, some of the benefits. So he was talking about comparison as one of the concerns as well. Yes, absolutely. He says, if they can do it, I can too. In other words, seeing someone like you get after it can inspire you and motivate you. That is true. But that doesn't mean that comparison is always generating healthy responses. In fact, it creates a lot of negative responses as well. But he goes on to comment further. Let me just give you a little bit of this quote here, because it's interesting to get into the mind of what these people are contemplating here. So he doesn't believe that social media is something to toss out. I'm quoting now from the article from Outside Online, but should be used mindfully and advantageously. So Ruzer encourages runners on TikTok to be selective in the accounts they follow, making sure they provide value and inspiration, though TikTok has a mysterious algorithm. Quote from the article, mysterious algorithm. It's assumed that if you follow less accounts of a particular type, the app will show you less content. It's assumed. This mysterious algorithm. Why do people say that? It's not mysterious. The people who make the algorithms have said what they do. Now, granted, if you put Mark Zuckerberg, is that his name? If you put him on trial in Congress, which they've done many, many times, he won't actually say it then. That's not the time when he's going to say, yeah, the algorithm is designed to do it. But the point is, the algorithm is not responding to my choices and what I'm trying to curate. It will do some of that because it can't necessarily deny what I'm trying to curate. Like, the function of the app is such that if I follow a certain thing, that it's going to put that thing into my feed. But it's also going to bring in other ways of showing me content that is not because of what I want to see. It's because of what the system thinks will get me to stay on the system, which may align with what I want. But more times than not, it's going to end up bringing me into places that I didn't intend to be initially, or seeing things that I wasn't looking for deliberately. So they note here the kind of the final comment, but if we are relying on social media for the majority of our connections and interactions, it's going to lead to an inevitable sense of dissatisfaction. And that's kind of the final conclusion in terms of, like, you know, so there's some goods here. There's some good positives here. But one of the things we always have to keep in mind with these social interactions, these social media are creating, what it amounts to is a false sense of connection. Not to say that you can't interact with people digitally, but a digital interaction is not a fully human engagement. And so part of this, we know, like, you can create the same sense of an interaction by interacting with an AI chatbot. If people don't know that it's an AI chatbot, they think they're talking to a human, and they think they're having it like an authentic interaction with a person. And you can go on doing that for a long time, and they think that they've built this friendship, and really it was just a computer talking to them. So that's a false perception. Like, I think I have a human connection, but I actually don't. That's not good. We need to have more good human connections and less fake human connections, or insubstantial, maybe I'll say partial. So Zach rants a little bit too much on social media, and I apologize, not on it, but about it. I apologize if it seems like I'm just kind of on a tirade, because that's not the intent. My intent with these perspectives is to call into question whether we should be spending time at all. And if the answer that you give is, yeah, I think there's some good things here and I'm going to keep doing it, so be it. I'm not going to say, well, then you're doing something wrong. But I think that we spend too little time saying, oh, we already know that there's some bad things, but there's also some good things. And I spend most of my time doing good things, not bad things. We should be a little bit more skeptical and a little bit more cynical than that, I think. Because I do think that there's way too much that we're kind of just not paying attention to about the negatives of how these things are influencing our lives. And I will leave it at that for today. But we've got some much more important positive things to talk about here with you in the coming weeks. As mentioned, we're going to be starting a series soon from Jim Lohr's work on wise decisions. That's going to be a fascinating examination. We've read and perused the material and are looking forward to bringing you in-depth examinations of a few of the key ideas. And then with that, we really just always want to be hearing your questions, so make sure you're sending them. Our email address is questions@a2zrunning.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining, and we'll talk to you next week.